try again. Here we go. Okay, our last panel, our last discussion is more of a panel, so we're going to do a little bit of a give and take. It's called Parenthood in the Digital World. And I think this is something that all of us understand, readily appreciate, that we're struggling with this. As Dr. DeBoe mentioned in the last session, we just live in a different world today. Everything is instant. Everything is digital. Everything is in front of our children all the time. They have so much more access than we had. Everything is immediate. The war that's being prosecuted now is being prosecuted in two places. It's being prosecuted in Gaza and on Facebook and social media. And it's impossible to minimize the importance of those, of both of those fronts. And the war on Facebook affects our ability to fight in Gaza. It's just the reality of today. So we have with us two great rabbanim, two experts in the world in which we live. First is Rabbi Yuval Shurlo. He's Rosh Shiva Bishivat Hezer Petach Tikva and a member of the Moetzet of Ein Zohar. He's from the small group of rabbis that 20 years ago created Yirgun Rabbeinu Tzohar. In addition, we are privileged to have also Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Weinberg, who is the Executive Vice President Emeritus of the Orthodox Union. And as soon as I emailed Rabbi Weinberg in New York and asked him to participate, he immediately responded that he was interested, and I appreciate his participating. He had to cut short of participation in the group. So thank you very much. So we're going to talk about, I'm going to ask questions and interrupt and interact, hopefully, and discuss several different aspects of the digital age in which we live and how to parent in the digital age. So the first thing we'll talk about is what I would call the dangers of the internet. Okay. Today in Israel, there's this thing that we all know called internet mimon. I'll just stick in my two cents. Every parent must have internet mimon. I think a family that has open internet in today's day and age, unfiltered internet, is literally asking for trouble. You're inviting your child and you're asking too much of them not to search and find things. Okay? But inherent in that is a problem. The problem is, if we block off our children at home, at some point in their lives, they will have unfiltered internet access. At the library, on their cell phones, we could talk about that as well somehow. How do we raise children, even though we block the internet, we filter it in our homes, so that when they have access, they'll still make proper choices about internet usage? So that when the filter isn't there, when the parent isn't there, then when they have the opportunity, they'll still be making good choices. So you guys, Rabbi Nid, can answer. Rabbi Shurlo, we'll begin with you, and we'll take it in order.
Shalom. I'll start with two sentences of apologizing. First of all, my English is not the best language that I speak. Hopefully that your Hebrew is better than my English. Okay, so let's say it that way. I'll try to do my best, but if I will say things that doesn't make sense, probably because I didn't know the right word to say, not because they don't have any kind of meaning. The second thing is that on every question that will be asked, I'll start with, I don't know. I really don't know. So I didn't come here to say only I don't know, but I want to put the title, I don't know. And the reason that I don't know is not only because I'm limited and all my disadvantages, is it's actually because I don't think that anyone in the world knows. And I want to remind one fact in order that we all can be relaxed. Can someone here mention one, but even one regular, normal family all over Tanakh? Did Abraham succeed with all his children? Did Yitzchak? Did Yaakov? Did Moshe Rabbeinu? Did Elia Kohen? Did Shmuel? Did King David? Did King Solomon? So let's all of us, first of all, relax. And remember the Mishnah that says, Lo alecha melecha ligmor, ve'i ata ben chorin libatel mimena. I mean, that's where we are. And after saying those two apologizing sentence, I'll say a few words what I think. And it's more because it's the last session, I will share thoughts, and I'm not coming with something that I know, but something that I think we should maybe change our approach, at least as it's, I'm going to raise a good question. Okay, I'm not sure that it will be a good answer, but at least it will be a good question. And this is the following. I don't think that our approach or our attitude towards the internet or the digital world should remain that this is another, or it's a new problem that we have today in the world. I think that our approach should be, it's a creation. The digital world is a parallel world. It's a new environment. It's a new situation. You cannot block it. And the problems are not only the sexual problems. Because if we think only in this direction, maybe we'll succeed. I doubt it, because Yetzer has, he's older than us, and he can find his way. But I think that we should, first of all, change our whole attitude. What is the meaning of a friend? What is the meaning of being connected? What is the meaning about information? Can you anymore hide something? For instance, the main new creation says that the most dangerous place in the world for our children is at home. Because when they are problem, once we said, you know, your home is your mifzaro, how do you say, your castle or your fortress. Okay, you're secure there. Today, he can be attacked at home much more because he sits in front of his computer or his laptop, and all what his friends are writing, and WhatsApp, and you know, all those social networks and whatever. He can be a very, very nasty person at home. He cannot do it when everybody sees him, but when he's anonymous, and if he's anonymous, he can expose himself only at home and not when he's with friends. He can do so things. It's not a new phenomenon. It's a new world, or it's a different world. And therefore, at least my suggestion is that we will not, our approach or our attitude towards this situation will not be that we have now a new problem or a new big problem. This is the world that we are going to live in. And that means that exactly like the, let's call it the old world, had the adventures and had the disadvantages and had the challenges, and in the bottom line, freedom of choice was the only way that people could face the challenges. I think we are still in the same place. Now, we should help our children. Maybe for a few years to block it will be helpful. Maybe, but our mission we should concentrate by understanding that all the boundaries, or most of the boundaries, and most of the walls, and most of our power to try to force them to do, or to try to create a situation where people will not be able to do wrong things, actually probably collapsed. And things are much open, and things are actually without no real limits. And the only main way that we should think about is how to enhance and to promote their freedom, good choice. That's my thought. Maybe I'll continue.
Can you give a couple of ideas?
First of all, the first thing is that our discourse with our children should be completely different. It's not that we are standing above and we are giving orders or saying the right things to do or trying to convince them that our values are the right values that they should adapt. The discourse and the way to educate our children should be a kind of an invitation to a dance. We are dancing together with them. They are coming, it's a situation where we are sitting together, we are leading, like, I'm not a great dancer, and it's much more than what I am really, but I understand that in dancing, when a couple dance, there is something that is trying to lead, being very sensitive to what they are saying. When I try to, let's say my kid is not waking up for, not in the digital world, I will ask him, not waking up for shachris, probably it's all of your kids too. So I will not give orders, and I will not try to force, and I will not, because it's not this world. I would, first of all, ask him, are you willing to discuss it with me? and not only to discuss, but maybe I'll try to find, I'll try to get to invited to our dialogue, and then I'll ask the questions, and he'll say, "Abba tafsik lachfo, stop digging." So I'll ask him, "What's what do you mean? Okay, so let's, you know what, we as good friends, what do you suggest?" And he will say, "Let's go to football," and I'll go with him to football, and I'll speak, you know, and I'll first of all be able to be invited and speak with him, and to. I'll say it as a, it's not a joke, it's a part of a very known show in Israel. The English teacher, Shaikh Ofir, was an English teacher in an Arabic school. And he taught Hamlet. And one of the famous sentences was, "What's the difference in Israel between a monologue and a dialogue?" And the answer was, a monologue is when one person speaks to himself. A dialogue is when two persons speak to themselves. So this is not going to be anymore the situation. First of all, I should buy his confidence, his trust, his friendship, his willing to to share with me things, because without that, he'll listen to everything we will say. Maybe he'll be blocked, but a minute later, he'll go to his own way to connect the world, to the WhatsApp, to the and everything that we said will be. So this is the first thing, how to create an environment that it could be a discourse of speaking, of dialoguing together, and then I'll continue later on.
First of all, I too will be saying many things that won't make sense, but I won't be able to say that it's because of my lack of the command of the English language. Baruch Hashem, I can speak English very well, but this topic is a difficult one for me, because I was once a parent, but I was a parent in a very different world. And then I became a grandparent, and I saw yet a still different world. And now, Baruch Hashem, my wife and I are great-grandparents. Oh, wow. And it's even a more different world. A very, very different world. When my 5, 6, how old is Tamar?
Eight.
Tamar's already eight?
No, six.
Tamar, six. Baruch Hashem, you know, she relates to me totally through electronic, her electronic expertise, which easily supersedes mine. And it's unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. She walks around with a little machshir, and she does her own thing, and that's how we communicate. And we communicate. I think it's a communication of a sort, but there's something very, very different about it. But we do live in a very, very different world. And it's frightening, and it's scary, and it's unknown, and it's rapidly changing. I mean, the OU ordered all of us. Finally, it took me 5 years to get used to my BlackBerry. Now they recalled the BlackBerry of all the employees. And a lot of employees, you know, on tuna fish boats, making sure the tuna fish is not dolphins, etc. And they took back our BlackBerries, and they gave us this new smartphone. And I'm not smart enough to handle a smartphone. It's a challenge. But it's a different world. But Rabbi Spalter mentioned the tool that you have here of Internet Rimon, which obviously is a useful tool, which has its limitations. My experience with similar kinds of programs that supposedly control or censor or whatever, filter, is that they are totally ineffective, because any bright 10-year-old, 12-year-old knows how to bypass the system very, very quickly. So maybe Rimon is foolproof, I doubt it. It may be foolproof, but it's not bright Jewish child proof.
It's better, it's not perfect.
Whatever, but that's side point. The point is, that I like to make, the dangers of the internet and everything we're talking about, Internet Plus, is not just the content, it's the process. You know, I make that distinction between content and process. The content is what we talk about, and the process, the way we talk. And there are two totally different, although obviously related and interrelated. The content can be pornographic or it can be sacred. The process itself offers problems. I'm not saying it's bad, I'm not saying it's good, but it offers problems. the process of communicating, the process of the instantaneousness of the process, the impersonality of the process, the anonymity of the process, the overwhelming amount of data that one can access, beside the nature of the data. Data could be lahavdil, it could be shells of chuvot, or it could be pornography in the worst sense of the term. But it's the process that has been looked at by many social critics, and I happen to be on that side of the argument. The process itself is dehumanizing. It's dehumanizing. And we're entering into a stage where the way that we communicate to each other is radically and qualitatively new from the way it was historically over the course of the history of mankind. We're communicating differently. It's a different process. The effects of it upon intimacy, upon sexuality, to go back to the last session, the process of it in every way is unknown and uncertain, but it's profound. It's profound. And I just want to mention that. So even if one finds the internet Rimon that's foolproof, the very process itself of gaining information this way is problematic. To give an example from a different planet, so to speak, historically, I, as I'm sure Avshalo, has the same addiction. Whenever I see a person who's a Talmud Chacham of his rank, I know that you share an addiction with me, and that is an addiction to purchasing Svarim. All right, we all have that. Our wives have different ways of dealing with it. I don't know about your wife, but my wife, Baruch Hashem.
You better buy shelves.
Well, she has a different way of handling it. But it's interesting. This is a side note. I stopped buying Svarim some years ago. However, because of my exalted position in the Orthodox Union, I get people sending me books to review, including Dr. Debo. I saw one of our first drafts of our manuscript. I was privileged to write the foreword for our final draft. So, and I just accumulate books after books after books for him, literally from the sublime to the ridiculous, literally. So I have that addiction. The interesting thing is there are many stories about that addiction in the history of the Gedolei Yisrael. And one story is told, and it stuck with me in various contexts over the many years, Baruch Hashem, that I've been involved in this problem of Svarim. And that is the Shagas Aryeh. The author of the Shagas Aryeh was a very, very poor man. He was poverty-stricken, and he couldn't hold the job very long. As he would say, with MS, you can travel through the entire world, because he used to tell the truth, and he got fired. So he went to the next job. So every time he told the truth, he went to a different job. And he was a very poor man. And once he was traveling and he visited Hamburg. And the Rav of Hamburg was Rav Raphael Hamburger, who was a Rav of a big city and who had a very, wasn't a rich man, but he had a beautiful library with hundreds, thousands of Svarim. And the Shagas Aryeh is reported to have said to him in Yiddish, "Mit azoy viel Svarim ven hot bezeit zu lernen." There's so many books, when do you have time to learn? The point is, it's a very, very important point, because the cognitive process of learning Torah, probably of learning any important skill, requires focus, requires attention, requires concentration, etc. And a library full of Svarim is distracting. And the convergent thinking process necessary for true intellectual study is interfered with when you have multiple stimuli. And now, Raphael Hamburger, however many books he had in his library, he didn't have the Bar Ilan, the CD-ROM. He didn't have access to thousands or the HebrewBooks.org or .com, which has, 35,000 or something Svarim at a press of a button. It can be extremely distracting, and it takes away, to a certain extent, from the kind of focus and absorption in the process of learning which is necessary. So that I'm speaking now about the process of electronic communication, of internet access, et cetera, not the content. Number one. Number two, in terms of education of children, it's pointless really to discuss the benefits, is it good or is it bad? It's here. as someone said the other session, you know, is air conditioning good or is air conditioning bad? Air conditioning is a reality. It's part of our life. And obviously internet communication, etc., is part of our lives. The question is, how does one use it? It's a very, very important lesson for parents to teach children. It's not a lesson that's taught well in an educational setting, and it's not the school's fault. I think this is one of the things. It's a beautiful essay by Ralph Hirsch, which I recommend to every parent. The essay is entitled in Hebrew translation, obviously he wrote in German, Shituf Pu'ula Bein HaHorim Leveit HaSefer. And he distinguishes between parental duties and educational duties. He makes a very sharp distinction, which is not necessarily relevant here. But one of the lessons, and he has a, gives a list of lessons that are parental duties, not the duties of the school. And one of them is teaching your children that it's that in to use religious language, in this world there is nothing that is evil. It depends how you use it. And the Chassam Sofer or others have used Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was shown the machat, when he was told to tell the Jewish people to give the machatzis hashekel. So the Gemara says, the Midrash says, that Niskashe Moshe found it very, very difficult. What does this mean in machatzis hashekel that God wants the Jewish people to give? So the Ribbono Shalom showed him a matbeya shel esh, showed him a fiery machatzis hashekel, a fiery coin. What's that all about? What did Moshe find so difficult about a half dollar? What's difficult about that? Give a half dollar if it's stucker. That's such a tough concept. You'd be a rocket scientist. It's a. And B, how was he given an answer by being shown a fiery coin? So various, I saw it in the Drosha to the Samsof. I'm sure earlier people said it as well. Moshe said, what? Money? Money? Money, the root of all evil, is going to be the tool through which you're going to build me a mishkan, to which you're going to come to the highest heights of spirituality through money. Boom, on money, fet. And therefore Moshe was niskashe Moshe. He found it very difficult. How am I going to use money? So Ribbono Shel Olam said, I will show you a matbeyo shel esh. Esh can be very, very destructive. We see it, just, you know, look on your little news of the latest events of the day, and you see how destructive age can be. On the other hand, age can be extremely productive. It can cook, it can illuminate. It depends how you use it. So the message was, just like age, it's not bad or good, it depends upon how human beings use it, so too money depends upon how human beings use it. It's a matbeo shel esh. You use it for a mishkan, and you build a mishkan. You use it for whatever, and it's the wrong thing.
Rabbi Weinberg, I have to interject. You said it's extremely dehumanizing. So it's hard to say that something can be good or bad if by definition the whole, the mahut of the internet is dehumanizing.
Right.
So if you can talk about how can we humanize it, or how, you know...
I can't quote myself, so I don't know the language
you can quote
I use.
It's fine.
But I don't know if I didn't mean to say that it is dehumanizing, but certainly it can be dehumanizing. And again, it's very, very much how it is used. The process of dehumanization depends upon how it's used. Exactly how it can be used and become not only not dehumanizing, but can even be used humanizing, I believe that as a tool, it probably can be used to humanize people. How we do it specifically, you know, it's beyond my high-tech expertise. But the tafkir of ours is to take this tool, which is so challenging in its content and in its process, and use it in a humanizing way.
Okay, so I'm going to pick up on something that you said also, you mentioned. I'm going to skip around a little bit. You spoke about the culture of immediate satisfaction, that's something that's inherent in the internet today. I just sent my son a text. I want an answer right now. People, I don't know if you have jobs, but if you have a job and you get an email, they want an answer right away. You know, they have statistics about how long someone's willing to wait in order for a web page to load, and it's less than 7 seconds, or they'll go to the next web page. It's not an exaggeration by any stretch of the imagination. How does this affect our show? I'll ask you and the Master of Shalom to answer. How does this affect our ability to engage in long-term processes like learning, Right? I mean, it obviously affects us. How do we combat this effect of the desire for instant response, instant production, instant everything? And how do we teach our children to try to overcome the instantaneous when so many parts of our life, email, WhatsApp, text messages, it's instantaneous.
I'll tell you what I think. I know it's a challenge to do this. But I just had a conversation with an educator here in Israel, an American educator, a Talmido Shel Hagon Rasalovechin, who now teaches here in Israel. He teaches American boys studying post-high school here in Israel. And he told me that, you know, their attention span is severely limited. In the 10, 12 years that he's been in the field, he's found a tremendous decrease in the length of the attention span of his Talmidim. You talk about American boys went through the same homes. They're all, you know, from Teaneck went to MTA, et cetera, et cetera. And they used to be able to listen to a shiur for an hour, and now it's 10 minutes. And it's not only the time span, but it's also the kind of stimuli necessary to hold their interest. So you have a serious problem with attention span. He tells me when he tells them that his rabbeim told him that they used to listen to a shiur of Rasalovechik, which went on for 4 hours, so his Talmidim said, look at him as if he's telling them some type of Hasidic Shemofes. You know, this is a miracle. Who could listen to anything for 4 hours? The question is, how did one combat with it? I would suggest that it had to be several ways, but one way has to be that we have to find alternate channels to teaching via electronic means. We have to find alternate channels. We have to try to expose our children to educational methodologies which do require more attention. Perhaps it has to be done gradually. Perhaps it has to be done through multimedia, etc. But the goal has to be, just from a religious perspective, but even just from a purely human psychological perspective, not to give in to the pull of this new tool which requires instant information. Because the fact is that just cognitive processes do not work as quickly as the electronic processes work. You know, you're not going to internalize the kind of knowledge you need to do almost anything if you can look it up at Google. You're not going to internalize mathematical formula. You're not going to internalize the Pshat and the Tosfos from what a Google can tell you. You're going to have to spend more time with it. You're going to have to incubate it. And we have to develop methodologies which encourage alternatives to just using the electronic thing. Even if it means, you know, we're having an hour class and, you know, not using any electronic media at all, we're just going to encourage silence and encourage meditation, contemplation, whatever it has to be. We have to make that part of our curriculum in some way.
Okay, Rav Shlomo, you're a Shiva. Have you seen the same phenomenon in your students here in Israel? And how do you combat it?
Definitely. I feel as a teacher, as a rabbi, that their ability to listen and to be patient and to do something, you know, even if they're sitting in with a laptop and every second they're watching here and searching there and whatever. I don't know. I can suggest at least two things that I'm doing and they're continuing the point that I said before. The first thing is experience. I mean, if my students, my mission is to try to take them over the experience of not using electronic instruments. I mean, what's happening when we sit together and the cell phones are not there and we have time and we're speaking? And once they felt what is the meaning of this, or what is the meaning of trying to search and trying to dig from your own thoughts, not from Google, and not from everywhere. And what is the meaning, or how do you feel when you search for things, and when you are analyzing things, and where you are trying to do those kinds of things, without their feelings about the experience, and without their understanding from the inside, they will not choose to sometimes block themselves and decide to make the effort and to disconnect themselves from everything else. And I think the amazing thing that we have, and I think the whole world should be jealous, is Shabbat. Shabbat is incredible, and we sometimes I'm using Shabbat in order. It's one of my missions and one of my goals, doing Shabbat. But it's not only that. Contemporary personally, I stopped many times. I'm disconnecting. Even though I like to do multi-functions always. I do 10 things in the same time, but many times I'm disconnecting myself from the internet and learning and having the experience to do that. That's one thing. The second thing is what we heard before, and that is we have to ask ourselves, another one thing. If I continue this way of thinking, I remember when we spoke with Rav Amital Zecher Tzaddik Livracha 30 or 40 years ago. He said the idea is to convert disadvantages and ask ourselves what is our advantages, and the fact that all the communication is completely digital, digitized. Once we are learning how to lead and control and design in real conversations. Real conversations, when you cannot say three words or you cannot send an icon. You have to express yourself. And we are not saying things. We are asking questions. We are asking the right questions. We are listening very carefully. We are trying to be as a mirror and tell them, you know what, I heard from what you said this. And then he thinks, no, I wanted to say exactly this thing. And if we'll earn or we'll buy and we'll train ourselves to use the advantages of a personality, of the personality discussion, of a real dialogue or whatever, they'll find themselves also searching and looking and loving to discuss. I want to say that in this thing, many of the psychiatrists and the psychologists say that the fact that they're drinking alcohol is because it's enabling them to speak, to talk. They need it in order to talk. Sometimes we can do it instead of them. Second thing is, let's convert the enemy to a friend, you know, להפוך אויב לאויב. And that is, as a rabbi, I many times, when there's a good question, we are Googling, and we are having all the answers, and then I show them that we didn't do anything yet. Because maybe we have the sources, maybe we have other rabbis that gave answers, but here, you can see that this rabbi said yes, this rabbi said no. Why? And now you have to read the text. And how can you imagine he will answer him and he will answer him? You can Google, you can look, let's try to use all those instruments, and there can be even a lot of benefits out of it. Instead of wasting time for things that we wasted a lot of time, I'm not sure it's a waste of time, but we wasted a lot of time. I remember my first day in my yeshiva, the son of Rav Amital met me searching for a book. He said, always come to look to a book you don't need. Then you'll find it. I mean, you'll never find whatever you need. So come with the book you don't need, and they don't need to waste this time. But once to convince them that having all the database is not enough, and actually now they have a lot of opportunities what to do with the database, and they had this experience, this is another way that we can face this challenge.
Oh, that leads to the next question. Very often we relate to Google as Harav Google.
Yeah.
You've ever heard of that phrase?
Definitely.
Okay. And there's a phenomenon also called the shoot SMS also. So now it seems that if you have any halachic sheila, all you're going to do is ask Harav Google, and you'll pretty much find more or less a spectrum of answers on anything, which gives very new meaning to the term Aseh Harav, because Harav Google will tell you anything you want. Which is a problem for two reasons. One, it gives the impression that there is no definitive Torah, because your Rav is Rav Google, and because any answer is correct. And at the same time, it gives the impression that why should I follow this Rav or that Rav when I can find a spectrum of information that's going to be also authoritative. It's going to be correct. And our children know this. How do we teach them Aseh Lecha Rav when there's Rav Google?
Okay, so let's continue. So you saw that there are numerous answers to this question, okay? Now, my job as a rabbi is not to ask him who's right, who gave more. At least I can do five things. First of all is, okay, so what were the arguments? And why did he say that way? And why did he say that way? And whatever. And therefore, he'll have to read the text. And he will have to answer the question. This is my job, to ask the question. Second thing I can ask, you know what? This is a good answer, okay? And you to select that because you're convinced this is the right answer. Now ask yourself, what is the consequences of this answer? Let's say the question was, are you permitted to clean the floor on Shabbos even though it's a rag and soichet or whatever, okay? And the answer, let's say, was yes. So try to think, those principles of this answer, where are they leading to? I mean, using the same arguments, say another five things that you can take out of those answers. And sometimes my educational way will be, you know what, you don't agree with the consequences. It's an absurd even to what you think. So let's go back to the answer. And actually you selected this answer because it's easier, not because you're convinced it's the right. I mean, this is the way we have to feel that we have to understand that we are in a new world. And when you have a lot of data, there are new things to do. And you can really inspire them, and you can really bring them not to look for the easiest answer or what but you can bring them to analyze and to do a lot of work from those answers, understanding the consequences, trying to build a coherent way of thinking. Maybe it's a lovely world. It's not a problem. It's a solution.
Okay, I want to turn it to Rav Weinberg. Rav Weinberg, could you address, from this perspective though, what about the broader sense that our children are getting that there's no answer to any specific question, that there's always every answer to every question?
Okay, I'd like to back up a little bit to the previous question and then kind of trend over to your second question. I spoke about the dehumanizing effect, or dehumanizing potential. The Rav-Talmud relationship, whether it's a Rebbe and a student in a class, or a Mora Horo who's giving halachic decisions with some woman who comes with a halachic spoon and a fleshic kafah, these are human interactions, and they have an interactional element. It's not a matter just of seeking information, finding the right answer. And the most dramatic story that comes to mind to illustrate that is a story that's quoted in the Sefer, which is a biography of the Harisha Meshoshela Brisk. And the Beis Halevi came first to wherever his first rabbinic position was, Slutsk or wherever. He came there and he was confronted by a woman. He came there just before Pesach. And he came there because he lost the Din Torah with the Netziv.
He got kicked out of the yeshiva.
But imagine, he was once the Rosh Yeshiva Balozhin, or was number two Rosh Yeshiva Balozhin, whatever exactly. And now he came to Slutsk. So he came, of course, with the Shabbos HaGodl Rosh, it was, you know, from the Beis Halevi. And then a woman came to him and said, Rebbe, I have a shaila to ask about Pesach. In 2 days is going to be the Seder. Can you fulfill the mitzvah of Arba Kosos with milk? So his immediate reaction was, like, about how the mighty have fallen, you know, Me'igna Roma Labira Mikta. I'm the Beis Halevi, I'm the Rosh Hashiva Valojan. Now they booted me out of Valojan. I'm here in Slutsk and this Yidden, they asked me a question, such a silly question. Can you be Yotze Arba Kosos with milk? And of course, he could have answered it like a computer. And he could have said whatever he would have said, what the halacha would have been, dry, technical halacha. But he started to think. This woman is known as one of the wealthier women in the community. She wants to have a seder, and she's asking me about milk for the Arba Kosos. So she must not have meat at the seder. if this woman from this wealthy family is not having meat, there must be some problem. She can't afford it. I better ask her why she's not having meat at the Seder, why she's... And therefore, it became not anymore a question that you can ask Rabbi Google. It became a question that needed a social work intervention. And he found out that her husband had lost his fortune. And he told her, I don't want anyone to know I lost my fortune. I don't want to become dependent upon the community. So we won't have meat by the Seder. And you'll ask the Rav if we can use the one goat that we have left and use its milk for our bakosos. And of course, then the answer wasn't Mutarosa or whether it's Kamar Medina, whatever halachic categories he could have brought to bear, which Rabbi Google would have. Instead, it became a matter of how do I get these people back on their feet financially, and how do I make sure they don't become embarrassed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is true in every halachic interaction. All right. If someone came to me when I was a rabbi in Baltimore and asked me a temple level question about the Melichikus, Pulniflechikus, I would wonder, in Baltimore, Rabbi Heinemann is from the poskim of our generation. What are they coming to me for? They're coming to me because they want to have an interaction with me. It's not because, you can go to Rabbi Google and find out that answer. You can find all the sheetahs of this or that or the other thing. That's not what the person's looking for when the person's asking for a shot. There's a human dimension to it. And somehow we have to recapture that. And that's certainly true in a classroom relationship. Even in the answer that Rav Shalom gave, it assumes that the kid who used the Google is also in touch with you. But he could have used a Google in his own study, in his own home, and never come to you for that humanizing dimension.
So if I can paraphrase you, so what you would say is, sometimes I could look to Google for the answer, or I could get the answer myself. I should make an example for my children and make an effort to call the Rav and ask the question so that they'll do that.
Because the lesson to the child is, in terms of your second question, is there absolute truth in halacha? Well... No, there is not an absolute truth in halacha because there needs to be a human intervention. Rabbi Google can't answer a halacha question because a halacha question is not a matter of looking up an informational point in a prima gadda. It's a matter of knowing the context, knowing the situation, asking the question, having a relationship. It's a human interaction. And the best variety of that, pre-Google, is to compare the Shelos V'Tshuvos of various Gedolim who were asking identical questions in the same circumstances and gave different answers. Totally different answers. Why is that? It's not just that they had an intellectual difference of opinion. It's because they were dealing with different contexts, different individuals, and certain intangibles that might not even be reflected in the text. But that's part of the process of humanization. That's what a Selach HaRav means. Selach HaRav doesn't mean necessarily get the many makoros that say, even if you know better than the local Rav, there's still a Selach HaRav. Because the human dimension of having someone to go to is the important thing. It's not necessarily the right answer or the wrong answer. That's a lesson to teach children.
Actually, we gave two different answers to two different questions. One question is, why do we need a rabbi when there is Rabbi Google? And that was an amazing answer. My answer was, let's say our student is working with Rabbi Google and he doesn't feel that he needs any connection with a human being rabbi. How can I inspire him, and how can I... not to convince him, because the word convince is not the word, I think, anymore. How could he, I can succeed that he will come to the understanding, what can he do with Rabbi Google? How important is still to study, still to work, still to do many other things, and in the same time to have a connection with a rabbi that it will at least start with asking him the good questions.
Okay, we're going to turn to a different direction. I want to talk for a few minutes about what we would call the family dynamic. To what degree has the internet changed the family dynamic for good and bad? Okay, first of all, we talk about closeness. Sometimes the internet can bring a family even closer together. I know many, many families, they have an internal family WhatsApp group. That there's communication.
Every family.
Every family. Okay. Okay. An inter-family WhatsApp group, especially where you're in a room of Olim, and we interact over thousands of kilometers, miles. Okay. So there are benefits. You group email, etc., etc. But there are costs as well. Like you said, everything has positives and negatives. So to what degree has this communication affected the family dynamic for good and for bad? And what are ways that we can combat the bad?
I'm not sure I'm not the person to give those answers. I mean, this is, you have to ask a psychologist or someone that has science, is scientific in understanding societies and families, whatever. I'll say, not trying to analyze the situation, but at least saying two things. And the first thing is that part of our connections will be digitized, but it's very important for parents and for grandparents and for everyone in the family to find the time and the efforts and the environment and the circumstances to have a face-to-face real dialogue or real speaking and real discuss, real hugging and kissing. And we should understand, there, as you said, there, because there are disadvantages and advantages, and instead of trying to analyze constantly, that's one, I think, important thing that we should do. And not to think, contemporary, I have now a daughter that is writing her postdoctorate in Cornell University. Now, I speak with her and the grandchildren, I think, more than I spoke when they were in Israel, you know, obviously, through the sky. And we had to decide, my wife and myself, if to fly to Ithaca, to be there, upstate New York, and sometimes I thought, you know, it's not necessary because we speak every day and we have those. And then I said, you know what? You forgot all the important things of face to face, of speaking and hugging and taking and walking together and touring together. And therefore we went there. I mean, we flew to Ithaca, and this is one good thing, because many times we are trying and we are, I don't want to say wasting our time, but using our time in the wrong way, trying to analyze, trying to understand, trying to make figure out everything, and we are missing the plain idea of doing both and without having a very, very sharp border between those things. That's one thing. The second thing, as I said before, is Shabbat and holidays. I mean, Shabbat and holidays for our children is really a big problem. It is a big problem. Without the WhatsApp, without the communication, you know that there are all kinds of Shabbos, Shomer Shabbos, that are using those, it's a real problem. Now, we have to understand that. Because we as parents maybe don't understand it. We're saying, thank God, Shabbos, everything is disconnected. But our children say the opposite. And that means that we have to do a lot of efforts that Shabbat will be a day that they will love. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult. It's more difficult in Israel than in the United States, because the only good thing that there is in the United States is Sunday. We don't have it here. And because of that, Shabbat is also the day we want to rest, we want to read, we want to sleep, we want to do things. As parents and as great parents, we have to understand that if Shabbat will be considered as a disaster in our grandchildren or children's eyes, it will collapse. Shmirat Shabbat will collapse because of communication. And there will be all kinds of... But, as I said before, if we'll think that one of our missions is to make the disadvantage to the advantage, and Shabbat will be the day that we are sitting together, that we are speaking, that we are playing, that even if we will not sleep in the holy Shabbos afternoon nap, I think this is something that is very important that we should do.
Okay, you mentioned it would be great if we had a psychologist here who could talk about family dynamics, and it just so happens that we do. Rabbi Weinrib is a trained family psychologist. So, Rabbi Weinrib. Family dynamics in the internet age.
It's interesting, and I mentioned before, I mean, my family dynamics are multi, Baruch Hashem, multi-generational. So it's not, you know, Papa, Mama, and, you know, Habenim Habat. It's more extended generationally and geographically and even ideologically, etc. So, first of all, in certain ways, this particular anti-high-tech person finds that it brings the family together more closely. I communicate with my grandchildren, and soon with at least one of my great-grandchildren, by texting. Of course, I had to learn new language. It's a different spelling, etc., etc.
We went back to the old Egyptian, you know, with icons. You're right, with icons. Right.
So I had to learn new language, but, you know, I could still... I still could teach me a few new tricks, but it does have a way of being able to connect on certain issues. That's the good news. The bad news is two things. First of all, the connection is superficial; it's missing the nonverbal and the physical dimension. And it's interesting. Rabbi Shalom is going through a whole list of sensory things that are missing. We're missing the hugging and the kissing, and we're also missing, strange to say, the smell. Mm-hmm. You know, human beings have an odor, and different human beings have a different odor. And that's part of the hugging and kissing, too. It's not usually often written about, but psychologists have written about it. But you're missing that whole, again, the humanizing dimension of it. There's another aspect, another negative, and that is, in any relationship, it has to be closeness, but there also has to be space and distance. And that's true with one's own children and even with one's own spouse and siblings, etc. There has to be some healthy distance. And sometimes the ability to communicate so much gives you an overload. I don't have to know what my kids had for breakfast and the fact that something's wrong with the car and it's not going so well with this boyfriend. And, you know, there's a lot that it's better not to know. It's better not to know. And the old-fashioned way, which wasn't so long ago, you didn't know all these things because, all right, the weekly phone call home was limited to, you know, send money. but now you can say send money, but you can also say, you know, at this difficulty, that's difficulty. You know, it's better sometimes not to know all of these things. It's interesting we experience it here because most of our immediate family, except for our Chayal Bodet, who's here, are in the States, and we're here because of the time difference. We communicate differently. We communicate differently because, you know, they will leave me something from last night's leftovers that I won't get till this morning, so they figure that they might as well not even tell me that because by tomorrow it's not going to be a problem anymore, one way or the other, and vice versa.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I
see. Okay, I have something a question that I would like to raise. That's sort of a pet peeve of mine, and I'm wondering, it involves both a rabbinic perspective and also rabbinic perspective. The phenomenon of downloading content, copyrighted content, is rampant in Israel, to the point where recently, in our yeshuv, a youth group showed a movie that's in the theaters, charged money in order to raise money for the youth group, that's still showing in theaters. They were charging money, you know, for admission for kids to watch the movie. And didn't think anything of it. Really didn't think anything of it. And, of course, as the evil parent, I raised it and incurred the wrath of my children. A is halacha question. Is it theft? Is it stealing? One. And then B, if it is stealing, this is not just that our children are doing it, parents are doing it also. What are the implications in the future that we are raising a generation of thieves?
I'm so glad that you asked this question. I must admit, it's really, I can go home smiling and very happy. Okay. And I'm very serious. Because I think that this question, first of all, is, as we said before in the beginning, the internet is not raising only those kinds, the porno websites and the problem of communication. It's really a big, big new world, as I said before. And the fact that as the most important thing, I think, as religious people, as observant people, that are committed also not only to the Orach Chaim, but also to the whole part of Shulchan Aruch, and especially to what the prophets spoke about Tzedek u'mishpat v'tzion v'mishpat yipadeh v'shaveh b'tzedakah. And tzedakah is not charity, tzedakah is justice in those words. That means that the fact that in this meeting we are speaking also about ethics, about morality, about dinei mamonot, about thieves, whatever. I don't have to say it. If you should bench shechiyano v'kimano v'giyano l'zman hazeh. I had a discussion with a lawyer that told me that he has a very big office and a lot of religious lawyers, and everybody's asking about working on Shabbos or having international marketing and whatever. So what do you do with Shabbat, and can you send for Christmas, can you send a greeting card or whatever? No one asked them if you can call a personal phone call or use the copy machine and all those and ethical questions. And that's one thing that I think, thank God that this is one of the questions, and we have to ask ourselves. Two, the internet in those fields is really challenging the halacha. And the halacha is way, way in back. Way, way, way in back. Of all the commercial and all the finance and all, even Lashon Hara and all those aspects of halacha, and it's very difficult to use the old world and the old structures of halacha when we are trying to deal with this new world. What is the meaning of earning? What is the meaning of ba'alut, as we say, that this is mine? What is so many questions, as you said, about rights and all and those issues. And I want to say two things. That one thing is that, as no questions, it's not the first time in history that when they invented the printers, 500 years ago, it started. Those questions actually was raised up, and the halacha had a big challenge. And I cannot say that everything was solved, but at least there was a direction, and there was something that the halacha actually created a new idea about being. The ownership of ideas of and the halacha would have to do that, even though, as I said, we are much we're very firm there. But the second thing is maybe in this new world, the importance of using the terms of ethics, morality, it's not fair, not using the halachic. Only the halachic forms. The halacha forms and structures are very important, and they should be the core, and they should be the priority even. But if I would have spoken with my child, I would have about this thing. I said, first of all, it's not fair. He worked. They are. It's not yours. And using those terms. The same thing when I speak with Haredi people about serving now in the army. I don't start with Milchemet Mitzvah and what Ramah said. I start with, first of all, we read last week in the Torah, Ha'achechem Yavou LaMilchama V'atem Tishvu Po. It's not fair, it's not ethical, it's not that someone else is risking his life and you are not doing anything, This is, so what I'm going to say, I want to say two things. First of all, as rabbis, as poskim, it's a great challenge. All the idea about credit cards through the internet, buying, selling, what is iska, can you be mekadesh isha through the internet? I'm talking about all the aspects, really many, many aspects. We can write the Shulchan Aruch of the internet from the beginning. It will take a long time. It will be too. When we'll finish the work, we'll see that we are in a new world. Yeah, and that's one thing. But maybe one of the visions that we can have is to come back to use simple words. Like in the shoot, we read that many times they wrote, She'erit b'nei Yisrael lo yasu avla. Yeah, it's a pasuk that people of the Jewish nation and that are observant are not doing wrong things, are not doing evil things, are not stealing and educating our children. It's very difficult. It's very difficult because they are downloading everything that is moving. I mean, even if it's not moving, but trying to educate in this direction, I think, is maybe can have a lot of influence on other aspects of life, being more moral and more ethical.
I also applaud the shift toward the ethical implications of so many aspects of the internet. And also the fact that, at least in my limited halachic expertise, halacha is way, way behind where the secular field of ethics is in addressing certain issues that come with modernity and post-modernity, and not necessarily taluy in the electronic media and in the internet. Ethics in advertising, for example. We've mentioned here intellectual property. Now, these are issues that halacha has a long way to go to be able to begin to deal with the intricacies of these issues. I happen to come across, as described to I don't even get this on the internet, although it's available, something called the Hedgehog Review. It's an intellectual highbrow. And each issue, they have a different subject. And it happens, knowing I was coming here, I browsed through this. It's called Minding Our Minds. And it has a lot to do with the effects of technology on our minds. But there's a whole article here by a fellow, a whole bibliography, about the ethics of precisely these issues. Now, just to read you one sentence. It's one sentence which kind of shows you where this person, whatever his name is, that doesn't matter. To find it out, I guess it does matter. I should give him credit. Moshe Mumro, right? Malcolm McCullough. I don't think he's a Hasid Shahid, but who knows? You never know. Maybe his father's name was McCullough and his mother was named Goldberg, and he's, I don't know. But in any case, he writes, he's talking about the specific issue of the superabundance of information, which is an issue we've just touched upon here, the superabundance of information. As I feel Svarim, when am I going to have time to learn? But he looks at the informational ethics aspect of the superabundance of information. And he writes, superabundance amplifies the costs of poor information ethics. Many of these costs have become everyday realities. And then he gives a list. Spam, scams, loss of privacy, pornography, identity theft, incivility, all right, Lashon Hara, Agnas Tvorim, etc., which pervades the email world, I think, in our own circles. Censorship, which is a whole ethical issue. We had a Rav in Baltimore. He deserves to be more widely known. His name is Rav Yitzchok Sternhill. And he was a Galician Yid, a Talmud of the Minchas Olozer, so he wasn't exactly a liberal progressive. But he was consumed with the issue of plagiarism and censorship in Sifrei Kodesh. He was consumed with this issue, and he was an expert on it. Plagiarism is one issue, and that's kind of what you were alluding to with plagiarism, but also censorship.
Just as an educator, just so you know, we struggle with it all the time. Kids in Israel, I don't know if it's in America, they think nothing of copying long stretches of information from wherever on the internet and submitting it as their own. And they don't think that it's not that they know they're doing something wrong. They don't even know they're doing something wrong.
So I look, that's just other Oinus Rachmana Batre, but it's still wrong, and we have a teacher, it's wrong. Censorship is another ethical issue. There is a lot of censorship in current in the whole world of Sifrei Kodesh today, where in certain circles they will omit tshuvas from the Chassam Sofer because they're too, whatever, not correct politically. Well, I don't want to say the word. Whatever. And for all sorts of reasons, Shlomo Zalman's Ksovim are thoroughly censored because of all sorts of cheshbonot. Rav Kook's name is censored from various databases, on and on and on and on. Don't get me started on that one. But here's McCullough, who's saying that censorship is also an issue in information ethics. I haven't finished his list. Polarization, disinformation. Don't think everything that Rav Google tells you is true, is correct. It's forgery, there's misinformation, there's quoting out of context, etc., etc. Things which a computer does innocently. you know, and yet which we have to watch out for, which is part of the problem. Disinformation, piracy, spyware, shutdowns, denial of service for Hulu. So there are so many, these issues, you know, we haven't even begun the Aleph Beis, the halacha for all of these, this whole realm of what he calls information ethics.
Wait.
Okay. I want to emphasize again that maybe we should, in the same time that we're trying to formulate the halacha about those issues, we should adopt a parallel discourse. And these are the prophet's values. Maybe they're better in this case, not because they're better, the halacha is better than that, but there are, can lead us to a good direction, because as we, both of us said, that the halacha is so way behind, that it's too long. And using terms in halachic discussion, that in the meantime, before or until we'll have a good halacha being written about that, using the terms of fairness as a halacha skill and halacha principle, and using the terms of ve'asita yashar ve'atov, and using the tzedakah mishpat, maybe this is the way, at least in the meantime, for first aid. Because if we will wait until we'll have the exact halacha about privacy and the internet, I think we'll never have it.
Okay, we're going to open it up to our questions if anybody wants to ask. Yes, sir. If you'll stand up and please speak so everyone can hear you.
Sure. I'd be interested to hear your comments on the impact on tefillah, on governing, short attention span, etc., etc. How it impacts on tefillah and how we can try and deal with it.
I mean, there was a time not very long ago when you were sitting in shul and it came time for davening, and if a person took out his gadget, his machshir, you would say, hey, what's he doing? He's taking out a whatever in the middle of mincha. Now, just like davening mincha here in the hallway, every person but me had mincha. Every person, but 30 people.
I heard there's a show in America that outlawed, that asked their members not to use them anymore.
Not to use them. For what reason? Not to use them. I mean, that's a good use of them.
Because
it's great when you're not insured when you don't have a seat.
Right. Well, it's only bad for the publishing companies. Let me talk about the psychological effect. It's happening right now. We saw it in America. I don't know the scene here. I just came here Wednesday. But the scene in America with the three boys, Nebuch, who were killed, abducted and killed. The question which consumed the minds of the, I'm talking about the Datiyim, Haredim, White Haredim, whatever, the from a Yidden, in simple mamaloshim, was, were our tefillos in vain? Were our prayers in vain? Part of that question came because the mentality is, tefillah has got to be at least as effective as this gadget. And if in this gadget I can find an instant answer by pressing a button, so why can't I press a button and say the exactly correct kapitel tehillim? Because there are people out there who will say, you know, in this case you say kapitel X, Y, Z, and, you know, and the mentality deeply ingrained in people is, that's how the world works. The world... It took me coming here to become familiar with the pitgam, which is going around now. Aman etzach lo mefached me derech arukah. It's a derech arukah, and tefillah is a derech arukah. And you deserve the, and not to be answered instantaneously is not a theological problem, but it has become a psychological problem. And part of it is because we are used to instantaneous answers to our questions and to our problems. It's interesting that there is, some feminists will argue, feminist psychologists would argue that what I'm about to say is heresy. But other psychologists, cognitive psychologists, have demonstrated that there is a feminine way of processing information and decision-making and the masculine way. All right, and tefillah requires the feminine approach. You have to take the tefillah and carry it for at least 9 months before you're going to have something to show for it. It's a project. I gave a Shabbos Shuva drasha once on the feminine tshuva and masculine tshuva. And part of the differences is masculine psychology is immediate results, fix it. And feminine, by and large, the feminine approach is it has to be nurtured, it has to be nursed, it has to be watered, it has to grow, it has to cultivate, etc. And look at in the words of tefillah, tzemach David Avdecha, there are so many botanic metaphors in the whole process of tefillah. Botanic metaphors because it's a process, it's a developmental process. And this is missing. On the other hand, the one of the issues, especially Hasidic Sforim, the old Hasidic Sforim deal with, is the problems with kavana in tefillah because you have machshavot zarot. Machshavot zarot are basically hirurim ra'im. They are usually of a sexual nature, at least to men. And these are distractions. And how you deal with these distractions. And there's a whole literature within our tradition of how you deal with machshavat zarot and tefillah. And this is precisely what we're dealing with today. How do you deal with machshavat zarot? And to go to a different field than our own tradition. The whole tradition of meditation in Eastern religions, in Buddhism especially, in mindfulness meditation today, which has become so popular, is a terrifically powerful tool in helping people get back to tefillah and to concentration and to what we call kavana, etc., etc. These are tools which have to be marshaled in the struggle that we are engaged in now with internet, etc.
I'm not sure that I understood the question correctly, but I heard from what you are saying that the tefillah should be shorter.
No.
No?
No, not saying
tefillah.
No, okay. It's also a good idea.
Okay, yeah. I want to say it's a good idea. I think because what we heard before about the problem to concentrate so long, the tefillah should be shorter. I'm not talking about cutting parts of the siddur. I'm not doing that. I'm talking about the gabayim. I'm talking about things that we are putting in addition. When I'm not in the yeshiva, I have a minyan that of people that are coming to tefillah. They're not doing anything else except tefillah, not reading, not mishaberachim, not ever. The tefillah Shabbat takes an hour and a half maximum, and it's a very, very powerful tefillah. And I think that the part that we are stretching the tefillah so long doesn't do good to the tefillah. In our generation, definitely.
We'll take one more question, and then we'll have to stop. Somebody here? Yeah.
I have a comment.
No, we do questions before we take on. I'm going to ask the Rabbani. I'm sorry, if you have a question?
You can reformat the comment.
Yeah, you know. Don't you think that?
Go ahead.
Don't you think that?
There are definitely benefits. The discussion here was to, and we are living in a world. The assumption of this panel was
because they were asking exactly about the tefillah and
It just happens while we're talking. I got an SMS. I got a WhatsApp from somebody. It sent to everybody to daven for a certain soldier.
And the other thing I wanted to say.
Very briefly, please.
That,
we'll just let it go. The assumption of this panel, we all live with the internet. We don't live in a world where we shut ourselves up. The question is how to harness it. We have time for one more question, then we'll stop. Yes.
One question.
We spoke, but this time
nothing to do with the digital world, more about honesty and because you spoke about that. And I teach in a boys' yeshiva, and the last pagut, I caught somebody trying to bring in an exam into the class, and I was so angry because they know the whole year I talked about how they have to be honest, that's the most important thing to me. And I was so angry, she said, it wasn't for me, I was helping. It's like, they don't get it that he's helping him cheat. Is that a good thing?
That's exactly what Lukiansky said in the Olmert trial.
Okay, I think we have to. You're welcome to talk to the Rabbanim. Thank you very much, Rabbi Filo, Rabbi Weinberg. Thank you all for coming today. I hope you enjoy, and Bezat Hashem, we'll see each other next year.